Welcome back to the FKT Podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today, I'm joined by Sophie Woods, who set the overall support at FKT for the 2,000-kilometer Via Alpina, covering the distance in 28 days, 17 hours, and 59 minutes. Sophie, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I'm really excited to chat with you.
It's awesome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I have a huge list of questions, but the first thing I'd like to start with is the Via Alpina itself. If you could just tell our listeners what and where this is.
Okay, so the Via Alpina is linking trails the entire length of the Alps. So it starts in Trieste in Italy and finishes in Monaco. You run through 8 different countries. It's roughly 2,000 kilometers with about, I think I got 117,000 meters of ascent and descent. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is a very long trail. I come from the United States where we have some really long trails, but I feel like in other countries, there's not a lot of long trails like this, you know, like the Terrara is one, the Via Alpina. I don't think there's too many others out there that are like of this length.
No, I don't think so either. And I think that's one of the things that really appealed to me is like, I didn't want to just go out and do something that was going to take me a week because I know what happens over a week. I was really looking for something that was like long so that I could just experience week 2, week 3, week 4, you know, and the Via Alpina, as soon as my husband suggested it, I was just like, wow, that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, that was my second question. Why did you decide to take this on? Because I looked at our website and this is your first FKT, at least on our website. So I was like, okay, I admire the go big or go home mentality here.
Yeah. No, I've never been that interested in doing an FKT because I love to race. I love racing fast women. I love finding races that have got really strong fields or are in environments that I've not been into before. And, you know, like going and doing a race, some of the logistics and the trickiness is taken out for you, right? Like they're supported, they have medics, like there are, you know, most of the ones I do are marked. So you know where you're going, you know that people will be there to save you if you need to be saved, like, you know, and so I think I needed something really different to shake me out of all of the stuff that I had been going through with fertility and the IVF and stuff like that. And when my husband suggested the Via Alpina, it was like fireworks because it was like, no, that sounds really amazing. The chance to take a month out of my life and go and run through the mountains that I absolutely love and see a bunch of stuff that I've never seen before. I was like, I can get on board with that challenge.
Yeah, for sure. So you had been to the Alps before, it sounds like. Had you seen most of the Via Alpina before? Or
no. And this is the coolest thing about it. I have spent like, you know, 6 weeks every year almost in the Dolomites and in the Aosta and, you know, in a bunch of Switzerland as well. And even in somewhere like the Dolomites that I know really well, I think I was on a trail that I knew maybe once. And so even there, it was taking me onto trail that I had never seen before into areas that I didn't know existed there. And it was the same with the Aosta. I've run the Tour de Gion 3 times. I've spent a lot of time like in that area, you know, just running on those trails. And again, I think I was on familiar trails for maybe like 3 hours tops. And then it was off into new amazing environments. It was a really cool trail.
So you start in Italy and you go through these other countries and then you come back into Italy again. Okay. Interesting.
And then you come back and then you leave it again and then you come back into it again. You dip back in just before you hit the sort of end of it. And I don't know whether it's considered I think the French bit is considered the Maritime Alps, but just before that you hit Italy again. And that was beautiful.
Okay.
I have never been there and it was so cool. Like, honestly, it's given me this list of places where I'm just like, must go back, must go back, must go back.
I love that about long distance trails. They give you this taste of so many different places, and then you can just be making that mental checklist of places you want to go back to and explore more.
Oh, 100%. And I think, you know, my husband and I, we're a little bit of a sucker for going back to the same places because we're like, oh, well, this was really beautiful and we really loved it. And so we'll go back and, you know, like run the same trails. And so to have this list of new places to go back to
right.
and actually really spend some time in and kind of, you know, I still very much out there, I was still able to enjoy everything. Almost. Mm-hmm. The end less so because of the sleep situation, but
right.
you know, still able to really look up and see the environment and enjoy what I was getting to be in. But there's definitely a bunch of places that I'm really keen to go back to.
So kind of on that note of seeing these new places and this trail taking you to trails you hadn't been on before, what was the navigation like? Is this a marked as a specific long trail? Or are you using your map a lot, GPS a lot, guessing?
Yeah. Look, sometimes the navigation was really easy and sometimes it was really tricky. And, you know, because you're the Via Alpina is the linking of each country's kind of Via Alpina. So, you know, the markings change with each country. There's not sort of any sort of consistent signage and there's just like a lot of, there is quite a lot of tricky navigation and just stuff that like certainly when you're tired, if you're not paying attention, you know, you're going down a hill when you're meant to go up a hill sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And did you make wrong turns very often?
I made quite a few.
Okay.
I definitely added in quite a few kilometers in the wrong direction sometimes and had to turn around and backtrack and, mm-hmm. you know, just kind of go, okay, well, so be it. Like, this is all part of the journey. I was not that zen about it, actually. I was furious. But
right. Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, wow, if you managed to be that zen about it, I'm impressed because I always just get so upset with myself.
Yeah. And often it would be in the towns, right? Like, where you're not paying quite so much attention because you're, I don't know, on road or whatever it is. And suddenly you're like, no, this was not the way I was meant to turn.
Right. I definitely tell people that all the time is that way out in the middle of nowhere, I don't get lost, but anywhere near an established campground or a town or something, because there's little trails that go everywhere. And like, you know, or you're supposed to, especially I noticed this in Italy when I was there, it's like, oh, I'm supposed to go through this little alley on this side of this building. And, you know, it's like, obviously I just go up this road that looks more, you know, straightforward. And
yeah,
there's definitely things like that.
The ones where you like feel like you are entering someone's property
right.
are always interesting, where you're like, am I just in someone's backyard here? Because I feel like I am. I can see them in the kitchen. Like, should I be here? Yeah, I think, you know, certainly because I've spent a lot of time running in Europe, like you kind of get used to that where you're like, well, this is where it says I should go. So this is where we're going.
Right. Yeah, I definitely got used to it eventually. But I still every time I'm like, all right, I feel like I'm going to go into this person's backyard. So I'm going to check my GPS and make sure this is correct before I just walk in there. Let's talk about the trail itself. What is, and this probably varies a lot throughout the course of the run, but what is the trail itself like? Is it pretty well established, obvious single track? Are you having to use your hands to scramble? Is it just, oh, I have to cross this and there's no trail here at all and I just know I got to go over there?
A bit of everything.
Okay.
So I was really surprised how technical it was. There were, you know, a lot of points where you're, you know, on Via Ferrata sort of rungs and, you know, some scrambling, some down climbing, some climbing up. There's like, I was naive in the fact that I didn't realize that they were taking hikers over stuff that was kind of what we would cover in a sky race, you know, in these really, really technical races that we have. And the thought of doing some of the stuff with, you know, a big pack on.
Right.
Like, I was just like, wow, this is, hikers are amazing. Like, this is hard. And I'm like, you know, used to doing this and I'm doing it with a small pack. And yeah, there was, you know, beautiful single track, like lots of amazing ridge lines where you are just on these single track, it's sort of sheer on each side. And sometimes there was no trail and you're like, okay, I'm just kind of following my pink line in this direction. you know, almost like the Brits will understand, but like fell running style, where you're just kind of heading down a wet kind of boggy hill, and just a bit of everything, scree, stairs, you know, tarmac, like whatever you can think of, I ran over it.
And did you generally have a sense of what each section was going to look like before you started it? Were you able to get information, or were you just constantly being surprised by whatever the trail was going to bring?
So I probably could have got the information, but I didn't do very much research on the actual trail before I started. Naively, right? Like, but also with that, I probably wouldn't have pushed it as much as I did. You know, there is no way I would have done a 20-hour day in the first week if I'd known what the terrain was going to be like. And so I think it was probably a little bit of ignorance is bliss. The information was out there for me to gather it, but it was a bit overwhelming because it's so far. It was like, okay, well, it's split into hiking days. So there's like a lot of quite short sections that I was just like, you know what? I know how to be in the mountains. I know how to save myself. And I know that I'm going to be able to deal with whatever the terrain has. So I was kind of like, I'm just going to go out and be surprised every day. Every day I was surprised.
Well, I mean, I guess that, yeah, there is something to be said for the ignorance is bliss mentality. You're not sitting here stressing out about, oh, this, you know, technical section I've got coming up, or, you know, oh, this section is really difficult navigationally. You're just like, oh, everything's great.
Yeah, it kind of was that. It was just like, look, because if I'd known, I wouldn't have done it on so, you know, the plan was never to have done it on such little sleep. The plan was that I would get in and, you know, I thought I was going to run faster, I think. Like, get in the afternoon, have time to, like, care for my body, have time to eat, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And the trail was just so much more technical than I was expecting. And because of the weather as well, I was having to move slower than I would have if it had not been so hot, that all I could do was just be like, okay, I just keep moving and it takes me as long as it takes me. And when I get to the van and they tell me I can stop, that's when I get to sleep.
So let's talk about sleep a little bit, or maybe lack thereof. How much sleep are you getting? Where were you sleeping? I know that there's restrictions on camping. So were you having to figure out huts every night? How did that play out?
Yeah, so that was tricky. Certainly in the countries that we haven't spent a lot of time in the camper van. So like, some countries are okay with you kind of like wild camping, but some countries aren't. Like in Austria, you're not allowed. And so I guess like navigating that. So predominantly I was staying in the camper, but then there were a few nights at refuges along the way. The problem was with the refuges though, is that they often want you to arrive at four or 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right. Yeah.
They want you to come in and like, then they feed you your food and, you know, you have all this time there. And I was sort of ringing them and being like, I'm not going to get there until 9, maybe 10 o'clock at night. I'll bring my own food. My husband would hike up my kit for the next day. And so we'd do this like swap over, and then I would just get hot water for a dehydrated meal from the refuge and, you know, kind of get a couple hours sleep and be the asshole in the dorm in the morning. But just to be that person in the dorm in the morning that's like, I'm so sorry, guys, but my alarm is going to go off at 3 o'clock. I will be as quiet as I can, but that's when I'm sneaking out of here.
Yeah. I was actually wondering about that. I was like, first of all, were you getting any sleep in a dorm? Because I always feel like there's somebody snoring and being loud. And also just like coming in late, leaving early, how that played out. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, one of them was particularly, they were so nice, but it was a particularly challenging sleeping situation because we were on the top bunk in a eave of, so we could, I couldn't quite fit my feet flat.
Oh, no.
I had to climb over people to get in this really, really long ladder to get back down. And I think I probably had about 3 hours sleep there, and I needed to get up to pee 4 times.
Oh, no.
And you had to go down the ladder through the refuge, outside, up a hill.
Oh, no.
To the toilets. Honestly, I was just a bit like, I feel like I should just sleep in the lows at this point. Like,
I was going to say, you should have taken the mattress out there and just slept on it. Oh my gosh. Oh yeah. That just sounds like, yeah. It almost seems pointless to be trying to sleep at that point when you've got all of that.
You know, but I think I was averaging around 3 to 4 hours a night. And that is not really enough. Every now and then we would drop in because I'd start getting really panicky about the fact I wasn't getting enough sleep. And so every now and then we'd kind of arrange it so that I had a night where I would get more. So I would sort of, I think the most I got though was probably 6.5 hours.
But
I tell you what, that was heaven.
Yeah.
Absolute heaven.
The best 6.5 hours of sleep you've ever had.
Yeah, because also it was like we had stayed in, I think, 2 or 3 hotels along the way. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like white fluffy towels, like lovely long shower. Like that was, there was a couple of really nice sleeps in there.
And were those planned strategically before, during, or they just kind of happened?
They were planned during. One of them ended up having to happen because we had a flat tire in the camper, Switzerland, on a Sunday.
Oh, no.
And so I left the camper that morning with no idea of how or when I was going to see George again. What I actually thought that could be the end of it for me, because I just thought, how on earth are they going to get that fixed? But also, how am I going to get stuff? And like our phones didn't work, which is a bit of an oversight of us, actually. Our SIM cards didn't, we thought they were going to work in Switzerland. We had checked, but they didn't. So I basically was,
I
came down off this mountain and I'm like, well, my phone's not working. Like, what do I do? Do I just like knock on someone's door? And I can't use Google Translate to ask them in, I think it was German, the German part of Switzerland. I have no way of necessarily communicating with anyone here. So it was like a really like, oh, okay. But then I was like, train station. Train station might have free Wi-Fi. So managed to get there. But yeah, that night I ended up staying in the hotel because I just wasn't going to be able to keep going to make it to anywhere. So we found a really nice hotel on top of a Swiss pass and it was glorious.
It sounds lovely, actually.
Yeah.
So a few things on that. So I want to hear more about, because obviously it sounds like they got to you. So I need to hear the story of getting a tire fixed. But also, I want to know more about your crew in general and who was with you, what they were doing, how often you were seeing them, that whole thing as well.
Okay. So my crew was my husband and my best friend, Zoe. George and I, so for some background, George and I have lived in our camper. We lived in our camper for 7 years, traveling around Europe, which was really helpful. Zoe has also lived in a camper. So the three of us were in this camper, but because we all knew like how to function in there, it made it possible. But it also meant that we knew how to problem solve in the camper en route. So the tire situation, I set off. George ended up having to get a train and a taxi and a funicular to get to me, to see me 5, 6, 7 hours later. While Zoe stayed with the camper, they'd managed to flag down a car turned out they had runners in it who recognized Zoe's Tour de Géant bag in the back of the van and were like, how can we help?
Nice.
So they managed to find someone to come and change the tire so that Zoe could drive to the mechanic, which she waited for the mechanic to then order the tires in. The next day they got fitted to the van and off they went. It was a bit of an oversight of ours to have not checked our spare tire before we left. It's just one of those things that you kind of forget about, don't you, until you need it. And then so that was a little bit of an oversight of ours. But so generally I would see them, it would really depend on the day, but it could be, you know, in an hour, it could be 2, it could be 6. I think probably the longest I went was about 8 hours, but often if it was going to be a long stretch like that, like they would come with me. So either Zoe would come with me the whole way or George would kind of come up with me a bit and then run back down to the camper and then drive to the next point.
And did you have any other pacers that were with you or were you running by yourself all the rest of the time?
So in week 3, I kind of got to the point where I had friends who were like in the area training for the UTMB or whatever they were, you know, or they lived there. So then I had a few friends come and run sections with me.
That seems like the right timing too.
Yeah, it really changed my kind of perspective. Like going into it, I didn't really want it to be one of those efforts where someone was carrying my bag. Or I don't know, like I love going out in the mountains with my stuff, with my bag and looking after myself. And I didn't want to have to ask people for food or for drink. I wanted to have that stuff on me all the time. And so, yeah, just having some friends kind of like show up and like bring, I just wanted to know what was happening in other people's lives. Like I wanted to know that normal life was going on, because I remember at the start, I think it was like a Saturday or a Sunday. It was like the first one. And I saw some people washing their cars. And I was like, it's wild to me that next Sunday, they're probably going to be washing their car again and I'm still going to be running. And the Sunday after that, they are probably going to be washing their car again and I will still be running. And then the next Sunday, like it just blew my mind that I was kind of going to be out there for that long and people were just going to be going through their normal lives and I was just going to be out running every day. Like it's, yeah. So yes, it was really wonderful to have friends join and to bring stories and distraction and, you know, just tell me what they'd had for dinner, stuff like that.
Right. And so since you were mostly, you know, carrying your own gear and things in between crew, what was in your pack? What were you carrying?
So typically I would be carrying two bottles of like a sports drink and then I would have my water filter with me at all times. Like I did some research before and it seems like that's the sort of thing that can really derail one of these attempts is a stomach bug. So I filtered everything. I filtered the water that said it was potable and, you know, from the fountains. I was just like,
right,
just it doesn't take long, just filter it. So I would have that and then I would have a waterproof jacket, usually unless it was in the like heat wave times, but I would have a waterproof jacket, waterproof pants, an emergency bivy. Just in case something happened and I could like, you know, hole up in that to be rescued. Obviously, I had my tracker, which has the vest function. I would have a first aid kit, bunch of food, often a long sleeve top as well. What else? You know, anti-chafing stuff, things like that. Just like normal sort of stuff to be running with. But yeah, that was generally what was in my bag.
And what kind of food were you carrying? What kind of food were you eating out there?
So I wasn't really sure how to approach this because I come from like a racing background, right? Where I just like smash like sugar drinks. Like,
right, yeah.
Like I'm just like, you know, just like in 24 hours and all I'm having is gels and sugary drinks. And so that was my base. But then I was very aware that I wanted to make sure that I was giving my body everything that it needed as much as I could. So I was having trail mix, beef jerky, pasta, gnocchi, like big bean burritos. I was having burgers. I was basically just eating anything and as much of it as I possibly could. So I was consuming around 6,000 to 7,000 calories a day.
Wow.
It was a huge amount. And my period arrived on time about 2 weeks in, which was really for me a really good indicator that I was doing a good job of making sure that my body was getting enough fuel. It definitely started to slip a bit towards the end, certainly when we started to push. And, you know, I think that I probably could have fueled the end a bit better. But I would say up until the middle of week four, I was pretty darn good. Like I expected to have massive mouth ulcers and like stuff like that. Like I'd talk to all my friends who have done big things like this and they're like, yeah, you know, canker sores and mouth ulcers and like all sorts of stuff. And I had the med kit that like I'd covered everything. So I was like, I want to make sure that I've got all this stuff because we could be in the middle of nowhere and, you know, like in Europe, things are not open very often. Like,
right.
You can't guarantee you can get something at any point. So yeah, but I didn't have any of that. Which again was another indicator that I was managing to at least give my body pretty much what it needed. But yeah, it was a lot of food to have to eat.
Yeah, I feel like, at least for me, that's something that always happens in the long efforts where I'm just tired of eating because it's just spend so much time thinking about food, consuming food. And it's just like, I'm just tired of chewing. I don't want to eat again. I don't want to eat anything.
I think for me, that's where the high carb sports drinks come into their own, is that, you know, as long as I was like, if I could just keep drinking them and then I ate when I saw my crew, like it was just such a good base. Because, you know, I mean, I'd say on average they have probably 300 calories in each bottle. And so it also meant that when I got sick of chewing as well, like my crew would give me like really well-cooked pasta. I mean, the Italians would have been horrified. Like it was like overcooked pasta, like really small shapes as well, so that you could just like basically like slurp it down. And, you know, ice cream slushies and things like that. Just like, I did get to the point where I was like, you guys just have to give me soft foods. I can't have, you know, anything that's like hard. Just mush, please.
I know we mentioned this briefly. It's been a super hot summer this year, yes, to say the least. So can you talk about the heat and how it affected your run? I know you ran into some wildfire issues too. Can you just talk about that?
Yeah. So I had two heat waves to battle with. Thankfully, for most of it, apart from in the Triglav National Park, there's not like a huge amount of water, but through the rest of it, there's usually a reasonable amount of water. And so I was able to, I mean, gosh, I was drinking 8 to 10 liters a day some days.
Mm-hmm.
I was just consuming so much liquid, which was amazing. But also, I mean, I need to pee all of the time, which was just super inconvenient. But yeah, so we packed me up with ice. I had ice in my drinks. I had ice in my hat. I had ice bandana. I had, you know, cooling tops. I got myself submerged in water any opportunity that I could, you know, sort of like lying down and like in the river and putting my head in and, you know, just kind of doing that. And also then I just had to move slower,
mm-hmm.
you know, certainly through the heat of the day. I just couldn't put any extra effort in, because I knew that if I did, the last thing I needed was for my stomach to go. And I know that right. when I work hard in the heat, my stomach sometimes is just like, okay, we've had enough. We don't want to ingest anything anymore. And I couldn't afford for that to happen. So I was just like, you just move slowly and you get where you get when you need to get there, and you try and keep yourself as cool as possible. You know, having my crew see me more often on those days was super, super helpful. But there were days where I couldn't fill up my water. I remember there was one day in Austria that we're like, okay, start with these bottles and then you're going to filter from this river or this lake and then you're going to filter from here. And I got up to the first lake and it was like full of tadpoles. I'm like, it's okay. We'll do it. It's fine. Filter right. from that. Yep. And then I get up to the next, and I was like, okay, great. Got my two bottles, like no tadpoles in them. And then I get up to the next one and it's like a muddy puddle. There's nothing there. And I was like, oh, God, all right, let's try. And I filled up my bottle and there were these little orange, like, amoebary things all through it. And
oh,
I was like, I can't do it.
No.
And so, like, that day it was a really cool ridgeline, super exposed, but also just hot. And I was just like, I'm just going to have to get dehydrated. There's nothing I can do here. I will have my wetter foods. So I will have my energy gels that might have a bit of water in them, and I will have, like, I don't know, my like more real foods that have a bit of water in them. And then when I got to the refuge, I was like, they were like, oh, are you staying? I'm like, no, I'm not staying, but I want every drink you have, and I want like five of them.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I feel like that would be so one of those things where it's so hard to predict, because I feel like it's been abnormally hot and dry. And so, you know, normally you wouldn't be drinking amoeba-laden swamp water, you know, but you go into this and you're like, oh yeah, there's a lake here, you know, it'll be great. Yeah. And then very
and then
unpredictable.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we chose July because we're like, well, it can be unpredictable in the mountains, of course, over the summer, but probably it will be maybe less hot than August.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and then, you know, we had second wave of heat and wildfires, which that was tricky. That was like I descended down one day into a small town that George had to hike up into, and he was like, look, you know, there's wildfires on the route and the whole side of the valley is shut. So you're not allowed to go on it. And I'm like, oh, but what a way, you know, because like this was my first FKT. Like, I don't know how diverting works and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So George is amazing. He'd done all this research. He'd emailed you guys. He'd emailed the Vera Alpina to see if there was like a diversion that they wanted him to take. And, you know, he'd like doing all of this in a foreign language too, right? Trying to find out where the valley was actually shut from and where we could get back onto the trail again. And, you know, by the time I got into camp that day, he's like, right, I have a diversion for you. It is higher and further, because we really wanted to make sure that we were within the scope of the kind of FKT. But also on the other sense of that, I kind of was just like, look, this is all we can do. Like, it's unsafe to run through that side of the valley. We're not allowed. We just have to go this way. And it was a really technical trail that George took us up. He's like, oh, it's mainly like fire roads. I was like, amazing. And it was not mainly fire roads. It was like, it was scrambling. It was like really, and Zoe was with me. We got down to, there was quite a lot of like, oh my God, if it's like this on the way down, this is going to take me forever. And then we kind of got to a sign and it was like, whatever the trail was, and it was like delicate. And it was like, yes, no, that definitely was very delicate.
Delicate. Yeah, that's one way to put it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. What country was this in? Where was the fire?
So this was in France. It was going into the Maritime Alps. So it was before the Mercantour. What is the name of them? The Écrins. It was that, like that area, which, might I add, is super cool. It's kind of like you've been in these big gray kind of mountains and then you get into the Écrins and it is like you are on an island. It's like being on Corsica. The rocks change, the plants change. It feels really, really coastal. It's quite different. I did not expect it to be like that. Really cool.
What was your biggest surprise out there?
How technical the trail was.
Were there any places, like when you say technical trail, like you're using your hands and sometimes you've got some Via Ferrata. Was there anything that you got to where you were just like, I don't know if I can do this?
Yeah. Yeah, there are a couple of points. I'm not super comfortable when it's like really, really small scree on a very, very steep angle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of that, you know, when you're crossing something like that, it's like, oh, this really, if this goes, if I go, I am going. Mm-hmm. There is not a lot that I can do to save myself. I probably could dig a pole in, I guess, and sort of like self-arrest, but it is that type of, if it goes, I'm going. So there was a couple of crossings like that. And then there was another point. It was actually where I met, so Jake, the men's record holder, had come out to cheer me on and it was amazing. But anyway, I met him at the bottom of a descent and he said to George, he's like, oh, that's a sketchy one. And it really was. It was, again, it was like if you're a climber and you are coming off a climb or you're getting up to a climb, and it was kind of like down climbing, sort of like a couple of big boulders, but then everything else in between is like super steep and super like scree-like. That, again, it was just those situations of like, if I go, I'm going.
Don't mess up.
Yeah, there's like not a lot to save myself with here if I go. And also it's just, you know, you're tired. So it's like you have to be even more careful just to make sure that you are like really planting the pole in before you take the step and, you know, really making sure that what you're holding on to is solid before you kind of step across something.
Right. Are there obviously not enough people who are hiking the Via Alpina? Because I'm just imagining this with a big backpack on and sounds terrifying.
Yeah, no, that's what I was thinking. I was just like, I don't like I met people out on the trail who were hiking it who were amazing, like these two older couples who were out hiking it. And all I could think of when I was on these sections was like, oh man, like this is tricky. And they had like, you know, not massive packs, but they had packs because they're hiking. Yes, I think there probably are variations for some of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not entirely sure, because it's also you would have to know that it was coming up too.
Right. Yeah.
Interrupt it.
That's where that, you know, preparation in advance comes in. Yeah.
Proper planning prevents poor performance.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Did you ever feel like quitting?
No, I never wanted to stop.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't, even when I felt horrendous, and like in the first week, things were pretty hard.
my body was super swollen. I think we had my salt out and everything felt like I was going to pull it. Like I really thought I was going to pull a calf muscle. And I was like, oh my God, imagine if it was all over in the first week.
Mm-hmm.
But even when, you know, like, I don't know, crying through the Dolomites or whatever, I never like wanted to stop. It was very much, I don't quite know how I'm going to continue,
mm-hmm.
but I want to continue.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I want to see this. I want to see all of these places. Like, it was such an amazing adventure.
I want to talk a little bit about the goal. Obviously, you went into this intending to complete it. You went into it intending to set the FKT. You took an enormous amount of time off the previous women's record, 10 days, and you took a week off of the overall time, the men's record. Was that your goal at the beginning? Did that evolve as you went along? Were you surprised at your own performance out there? Like, how is this adjusting as time went on?
When I looked at it, I kind of looked at the distance and the elevation, and, you know, George and I talked about it, and we're like, probably, like, it wasn't like I was going, oh, I really want to go and beat the men's record. It was like, that distance and elevation, I reckon I can do that in 30 days. Because I'm also a bit like, the 30 days was a lot to take out of my life. It was a lot for my husband to take out of his life, you know? Like, it's quite a privilege to be able to step away from all of your responsibilities like that for a month. So I was like, that's enough. A month is enough to be running as well.
Right.
You know? I mean, maybe now I know I can do a month. Maybe we go longer. Who knows? But like at that time, I was like, that's a really, that's enough. That's big enough. And so it was kind of, it was more about thinking about what I could do on that route than necessarily I'm going to go and take X amount of time off these records. The fact that we were able to take it, to make it even faster, so to get to do it in 28 days instead of 30, that was really cool because I didn't expect that. But it's because we got to 170K at the end, and George was like, do you want to know how far you've got to go? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, 170. I was like, no, I know that. That's a UTMB. I know that distance. We can, like, let's treat it like a race now. Let's push and let's go. Because I also, and this sounds ridiculous now when I say it, I really wanted us all to have Sunday off. Right? Like, it's just,
yeah.
Because I could see George and Zoe deteriorating, you know, along the way, and there was nothing I could do to help them. All I could do was keep moving forward, and that was the best gift that I could give them, was to actually just do it faster so that we could all stop and then actually have a decent night's sleep. And so I think that's kind of how it evolved along the way. But I do think in hindsight, actually pushing at the end did take a little bit of enjoyment out of those last 2 days. You know, mm-hmm. I had so little sleep, and I wasn't able to kind of enjoy the trail in the way that I'd enjoyed the 26 days before.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what that push was like, and like also how it felt to finish?
So to push at the end was... It was hard. I'd managed to keep my body in really, really good shape. You know, like normally things go wrong for me in races. I seem to have like more than my fair share of like weird stuff happening, you know, like lose my eyesight, break a finger, like just things happen. And so I kind of, and I shouldn't have said it, I said to George, I was like, I'm not going to get through this without anything weird happening to me. I mean, I did have a weird rash for a while from a washing powder that we'd used, but then towards the end, I think because of the push and because I wasn't having really any recovery, small wounds started to open up on the balls of my feet. Mm. And that was new and very painful. But at that point, we were just, you know, you're so in it. It's just like, okay, we're just going to tape it. Zoe had these metatarsal pads, which were game changing. They were amazing. But yeah, so I think that last bit, you know, we were all functioning on so little sleep. Like, that's when we finished, we're like, yeah, 29 days. And then when we went to submit it, it was like, oh, no, we actually did it in 28.
I did that on my first FKT as well.
Oh, that makes me feel better. Because I was yep. just, like, we were like, yeah, we did it.
So sleep deprived. Yeah.
And you know what? But actually finishing, like, I don't know if you've experienced this, but honestly, there was kind of nothing.
Hmm.
Like I didn't have any of the like good hormones left. Like there was no dopamine or serotonin. There was just like relief, relief that I had not messed it up in the last, you know, couple of days. I hadn't twisted an ankle and I was so focused on that, even running through Monaco. I stubbed my toe on a curb or something like that. And I'm like, no, you've just got to look after yourself to get to the finish. Because, I mean, probably at that point I would have crawled, but you could still like stack it and like, I don't know, bash your head and have to go to hospital. And I'm like, I was so aware of getting to the finish that kind of when I did get to the finish, I was a bit like, like a shell shocked, I guess.
Yeah. You just sort of like, oh, that happened.
that was really far. That was like, it was also just a lot harder than I expected, the whole thing, right? Like it was,
right.
Not that I didn't expect it to be hard, but just there was just like, yeah, it was really hard. Not all the time, but it was really hard. And I like enjoyed probably 95% of it, but it was still, that 95% was still quite hard. Uh-huh. And so to get to the finish and also running through Monaco too, right? So you arrive, I stink. I like have it, you know, I was pretty good with showering up until that point, but in that last push, there just wasn't time. So it was like, right. You know, probably 48 hours, you know, without a shower and like just gross, muddy, head torch on, you know, shuffling through the streets of Monaco. And there's everybody like beautiful,
right?
And white, smelling just divine. Like looking at me like, what is this creature that is like shuffling, you know, on the footpaths here? Yeah, it was quite a challenging thing to kind of come into and to see like real life again.
Right. Yeah, you're happy for your friends bringing you real life onto the trail, but then it's very different to run into Monaco and see that real life. Yeah. So what was the first order of business? Obviously sleeping, I'm sure. Did you stay in Monaco or did you drive somewhere else? What did you do right after you got done?
So right after we finished, we went and ate. I tried to have fish and chips and I probably had to go and throw it up.
Oh no.
Garden. Oh yeah, no, it wasn't a good, it's like right next to some police too. I was like, oh my God, please don't see me doing this. I'm not like someone who's drunk. So we tried to do that. That didn't really work. And then we went to, George had rented a apartment for us to stay in for that night because I had a BBC interview at, I think it was, I don't know, I want to say 8 o'clock the next morning.
Oh, wow.
So we got in, like it was hard for us to get back to the van and get the stuff and get to the apartment and like, you know, shower. And then I didn't have huge amounts of sleep that night and then had to get up and do this BBC interview, which honestly the blow dry for that almost killed me. But yeah. I was like, you, Sophie, you need to look okay on this because like your parents are probably going to see it. Like you just don't want people to worry. Like put some makeup on, blow dry your hair. So it suddenly was just like thrust back into like civilization, really.
Right.
And then after that, we drove back to Andorra that day. Like we stopped a bit and slept along the way, but we dropped Zoe off at the airport. And then, you know, my plan was that we were going to have this nice Sunday, maybe like lounge in a pool. Like these were all the thoughts I was having in that last push. And like I was saying to Zoe, I was like, oh, we could lie in a pool and like have an Aperol and, you know, like all of this. And it was just like, actually, no, none of us want to be in this van anymore. Like we all just want to be in our own beds. So it was like, okay. Drop her off, drive back to Andorra, and then just try and sleep as much as possible.
Yeah. I think that there's always this interesting juxtaposition between those end of FKT fantasies that you have about food and sleeping and being in the pool or the nice drinks, and then what actually ends up happening, which is kind of why I wanted to know. I was like, all right, once you got there, what actually happened?
Yeah, no, none of the things that I was hoping for. I wanted to finish as well. I was like, I'm going to try and finish at sunset. You know, Zoe, like she's a photographer, right? So they loved sunrise and sunset. It's always like the light. So I was like, Zoe, I'm going to try and finish by sunset. You're going to get amazing photos, you know. I did not finish by sunset. I did manage to finish when there was a fireworks display going off in Monaco.
Well, there you go.
So that was pretty amazing to run down into Monaco and feel like all the fireworks were going off for me. Our dog was not having a good time with that. But yeah, no, and it was incredible at the finish. There were two amazing ladies a daughter and mother who had made signs for me and who had come. Yeah, it was so, so lovely. Honestly, it was just so, so lovely to just to have that support, right? Like, you know, it was, yeah, really cool.
I'm sure there's lots of things that we haven't covered. But is there anything else you'd like to share that we haven't talked about today?
No, but I have a question for you with all of the stuff that you've done. Did you get that weird hard skin on your feet?
Yes.
And is there anything you can do to stop it?
I do get the hard skin on my feet. No, after you're done, it goes away.
It goes away like you become a lizard and it like peels off.
Yeah, it peels off. Yeah. And I feel like people have seen my feet after things and they're just like, what is happening there? I'm like, well, my foot doesn't need that extra layer of skin anymore. It's just going to peel off.
It's like, kind of like corpse foot. It's
a little disturbing. Yes.
Yeah. So that was quite a new experience for me, that situation.
Yeah. Just don't go get a pedicure because they'll be horrified. Just deal with that yourself at home.
Yeah, no, they've had like daily soakings and scrubbings and the hope to try and like start to remove
pumice stone and lots of lotion. But yeah, I think it's kind of cool though to see the way the body adapts to something. Like the fact that my feet just grew an extra layer of skin to do the thing I asked them to do. You know, it's really gross when it comes off, but also really cool that my body's like, okay, well, we can deal with this. Like, well,
That was one of the things that I was so amazed with through that whole process was just like how my body showed up for me. You know, like I've heard from, you know, through hikers that like you can get fitter. And I felt like I did. Like week three, I was just eating up those climbs. Like I was like, nah, 4,000 meters, 5,000 meters today. It's okay. Let's go at it. You know, let's go do it. And yeah, it was an incredible thing to witness. The body just being like, okay, well, this is our life now. And mm-hmm. this is what we do every day. So, okay.
It's incredible, really. Like, you know, I mean, obviously as runners, we train our bodies all the time. So we have this expectation that it will make adaptation. But I think it's really incredible when you are pushing yourself in this extreme way to see that, oh, my body can even still adapt to this, you know, because I feel like a lot of times in our training, it's just like, okay, well, we do this and then we do this and then we take a break and then we do this. And you're trying to balance the overloading with the resting and this. And then you go out there and you do something like this. And it's like, oh no, my body can just keep delivering and I'm not giving it any rest. I'm not even eating right. And here it is. I mean, obviously there's a limit to when that all falls apart, but it's incredible to see our body's ability to be resilient.
And to just, I guess, to be so in it with your body, right? Like, I think when we're training, you know, yes, the adaptations are happening, but they're kind of like, as you said, like happening over weeks, over months, you know, there's these small little adaptations. But then when you go out and do something like this and you're like present with your body adapting is wild.
Yeah.
Really, it was amazing.
Definitely. Yeah, it gives you this connection and depth to your body that I feel like is missing in most people's lives, you know, unless they've done something like this. So now that you've had this experience, you've got this new connection with your body, what's next?
On Monday, my husband and I will be lining up for the PTL, which is the 300-kilometer UTME race.
Excellent.
Yep. So I'm hoping that my body is going to show up to me again for that. And
do you feel like you've caught up on your sleep and you're ready to take this on? Like, do you?
I mean, I went up a hill this week and didn't feel like death. So I think that is
that's a good sign.
It's progress. Look, no, it's a terrible idea to do something like this quite so soon afterwards. And I'm going to have to take a good chunk of time off afterwards to just let my body properly heal and let my endocrine system have a reset and a rest and all of that sort of stuff. But then I think I'm going to have to find another one.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. I didn't expect to enjoy it as much as I did, but it was just so much fun. Like, I don't know, I can't describe the excitement and the joy that I had of being in these new places and kind of it like being me against the clock, you know, like, yeah, and just having the opportunity to go into these environments for such a long time and like step out of your life and all you have to do is eat and move. Like, I really enjoyed it. I don't know what I'm going to do yet next, so I'm open to suggestions.
Well, we have some nice long trails in the US.
I think
that you would enjoy.
I've had to stop my husband from looking on the FKT website. I'm like, not yet.
Yeah, you have to let that short-term memory loss fully take place.
Absolutely.
You know, it's gonna take a couple months and then you'll forget all the hard things and all the foot skin will have peeled away and, you know, you'll be like, oh yeah, that was great. I'd like to do that again. Then you can start looking.
Yeah, definitely. I think so.
Well, good luck at PTL and thank you very much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Thanks again, Sophie, for coming on the show. You can read about her FKT on the website, fastestknowntime.com, and follow her adventures on Instagram at Sophie Amy Grant.